Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're back on Brexit. Martin is busy getting his voice box service, so I'm flying solo. Without further ado, I'm delighted to be joined by writer and columnist, and as it's her third appearance, certified friend of the pod, Dawn Foster. Dawn, how are you?
Good, babe. How are you?
I'm good. I'm saying I'm good because that's the Irish way of saying, you know, everybody asks you how you sure I'm grand, but I suppose I have more of a statement, an opening statement than a question. It's a clown car shit show wrapped inside a bad Carry On movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, last night I got home very, very late. Obviously, I haven't been on TV running around all day, and me and my flatmate were trying to find something to watch on Netflix, and we saw this kind of apocalyptic drama called, like, London Has Fallen. We sort of looked at it and just thought, well, it can't be as apocalyptic as actual politics and life is at the moment, so forget it.
Yeah, no, and that is funny, because literally minutes before I called you, I saw a tweet where it says, the Queen to be evacuated in case of trouble, and you're like, oh my god, like, is this where we are now? You know, it's obscene. But I suppose essentially I've one big question for you to begin with. What we've heard, depending on what side of the divide you sit, is someone said to me was, I saw Sky News called what Boris Johnson did in proroguing the parliament is an audacious and brilliant strategical move, and other people on the other side have said it is totally anti-democratic, and that if it happened in, say, a South American country, there would be people on the airwaves now calling for full and free elections immediately. Where's the truth in this?
I think that essentially what has happened is that Boris Johnson has made a big gamble. So for somebody to say that it's a brilliant, bold, strategic move, you can only really say that if you know what will happen as a result of it. So if, for instance, Boris Johnson does this and manages to push through a Brexit deal, Brexit comes off, he then calls a general election and wins,
yeah,
then you can say, yes, it was a bold strategic move. But the problem is that it's very, very likely that this will completely blow up in his face, that everything will continue to become even more chaotic, and absolutely nobody knows what is going to happen in the next few weeks. We've got, at the end of September and the beginning of October, we've got 2 weeks of the Labour Party conference followed by the Conservative Party conference. And then ordinarily, you know, Parliament would have gone back. And instead, Parliament's going back 2 weeks later than it should be. And then we have 2 weeks, 2 weeks in Parliament before the Halloween Brexit deadline. And that still isn't 2 weeks of debating, because obviously because of how ludicrous Westminster is, the Queen has to open.
Yes, she has to open Parliament.
Yeah, so a lot of time is taken up with all of these ludicrous kind of ludicrous historical kind of procedures, and so there isn't going to be that much time to debate. We still don't know whether or not Boris Johnson will have a new deal from Europe. Every European leader says no. The Conservatives keep saying that he will come back, the backstop will disappear from the deal, there'll be loads of news, brands, flashing lights, wild, glittery, spangling new things added to the deal, but there isn't going to be much time to debate, and, you know, it could all completely blow up. So if Parliament had gone back, on time, and there'd been a month to debate, the first thing that would have happened is, because the opposition parties have finally kind of agreed that what they were going to do was to move to block a no-deal Brexit, and then as a last resort, call a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson. Whereas instead, because there's so little time, what may happen instead is that the opposition parties may just go straight for a vote of no confidence. And I think, the reason why Boris Johnson moved to try and get less debating time was to put the thumbscrews on Tory MPs, Tory rebels, to essentially put the fear of God into them so that they got behind him, pushed through the deals, you know, that Theresa May never managed to. But it may blow up. So instead, the Tory rebels may say, no, you've gone too far. We're actually going to go with Labour, the Lib Dems, the Greens, the Scottish National Party, and they may just block Brexit. They may block a no-deal Brexit, and it may completely blow up in his face.
Yeah, it's real high risk, high reward potentially, but there's also the other side where they'll tell you that there's also the chance that they're more afraid of the Brexit Party, the threat of the Brexit Party taking their seats if they're not seen to deliver it. And I think that may be one of the calculations Boris is trying to, that not really that they're afraid of him, but they're more afraid of that that the 17 million people who voted for Brexit will punish those who don't actually go through with it. And you know, I who can actually say, because you know, there was always the expression that, you know, there's many different Englands and there's many different UKs, and it clearly is now that there's a huge disconnect between large parts of the electorate. And I saw, just speaking on the EU, I saw Michel Barnier today saying that they will, you know, that they will protect the EU's interests, the citizens, the companies, and stability on the island of Ireland. I don't know how much, you know, giving the withdrawal agreement in fluorescent ink or something, what they're going to change.
Yeah, I mean, just to row back to the point you made, because it's just completely spot on, it's very, very clear that the main reason behind this is that Boris Johnson and the Conservatives are completely terrified of the Brexit Party.
Yeah.
So it's really, really interesting. If you look at the Conservatives' messaging, if you go on their Twitter, if you go on their Instagram, there's been a big kind of shift in the last couple of days, let alone weeks, where they have clearly started trying to adopt the language of the Brexit Party. They're trying to use the same messaging as them. They're trying to use a lot of the rhetoric and a lot of the themes that the Brexit Party use, because they're terrified of losing voters and seats to the Brexit Party. And obviously, you know, I'll fully admit that I'm not in the game to increase the number of Conservative MPs. But I think that strategically it's really quite stupid, you know, for the Conservative to do that, because if, you know, I think one of the problems with Labour historically, you know, between 2010 and 2015, when they lost two general elections, was that they always fought every general election based on swing voters in the middle. So everything was
playing to the centre.
Yeah, so at no point did Labour ever think, why don't we try and target the people who don't vote? You know, there was this belief in the British election, in the British election system, that people who vote, and people who don't vote will never vote. There's no point trying to reach them. One of the reasons Labour did so well in 2017 was that they got loads of people who hadn't voted before registered and voting and excited. And Conservatives are basically trying to chase Brexit, you know, people who made the Brexit Party. But UKIP, even though they may have hoovered up some Conservative Party voters, they still never managed to actually win a seat in Westminster. The only time they ever had an MP was when a Conservative MP crossed the floor to UKIP. So UKIP never actually won a single seat. I don't think the Brexit Party would actually win that many seats. And so the Conservatives may instead alienate a huge number of moderate Conservatives who might vote Lib Dem. They might even protest vote and vote for Labour. It's very, very likely that a lot of Scottish and Welsh voters who previously voted for the Tories may vote for Labour, they may vote for Plaid Cymru, the Greens, the Lib Dems, the Scottish National Party.
Yeah.
There's a big danger that by chasing the Brexit Party voters, they actually lose a lot of seats, and the Brexit Party still don't win many.
I happen to share that opinion. I think what we've seen over the last over the last decade of austerity and things like that is that you're not going to, you know, the that genie is out of the bottle, and, you know, chasing that side is actually going to put off some of the more what we will call centrists or moderates. And yeah. I think, you know, who is that? If that's where you want to be associated, I'm not so sure that that's a good strategy, but I do think it is Boris Johnson's overall strategy. I do think that he thinks, okay, the Brexit Party are our main threat and the other guys aren't together. But I have seen actually that they are together, as you said a few minutes ago, that they've managed to cobble together enough of a coalition to say, you know, if Parliament was going to sit, we will bring it down with a vote of no confidence, because, you know, the Lib Dems, Labour, the Scottish National Party, they're putting forward, I don't want to say alternatives, because they haven't got an alternative to sorting out the whole big question of Brexit, whether, you know, whether you believe it's got to be a people's vote or a second referendum or whatever the tactic is, but at least they've agreed that we don't want this potential hellscape, you know?
Yeah.
Can I ask you, though, are you getting a sense that it's become deeply entrenched now to the point where the negotiations aren't going to happen, that this is going to be a successful kick for touch, and that are we looking at a general election, or are we looking at a crash out Brexit?
I think we're definitely going to see a general election. I think that essentially what Boris Johnson hopes to do is to get Brexit, and it may, I still think there is a very, very real risk of a no-deal Brexit. I still think there's a very, very big risk that we crash out on October the 31st, because Boris Johnson doesn't want to go, he wants a general election, but he doesn't want to go into a general election unless he's delivered Brexit. And it's now almost too late to call a general election before October the 31st.
Yeah.
And the EU has said, you know, you've had so many extensions, the only reason we would give another extension is if you had a general election. And Johnson knows that if he goes into a general election without having delivered Brexit, Jeremy Corbyn's in number 10 without a shadow of a doubt. So he doesn't want to do that. So I think that he is more than happy for a no-deal Brexit to happen. And I think the Conservatives, you know, not the entire party, but the Conservatives were clustered in number 10, and the really hardcore leavers are genuinely convinced that there aren't going to be that many problems from a no-deal Brexit. So if they go into a general election, then they will have pleased their voters. There won't be many problems. You know, there won't be backups in Dover of loads of
I can tell you, as someone who this day last week went through London and Calais, it won't be a bed of roses, because it really will be. Like, I mean, we make the point in Ireland, and I'd look through the Irish lens, that the real issue will be when on the 2nd of November, when there's milk sitting at the border going off because it can't be transferred to where it gets pasteurized. You know, these are real deep concerns that we have here that we haven't really, you know, gotten that message out to people, that this is actually genuinely food shortages, or if not food shortages, the things that you're used to having on your shelves might not be there for some time. And in the UK, I was talking to a woman, and she said a very unusual thing to me, which was, she said, I don't want to make fun of her, because she believed in her heart and that Brexit needs to be delivered, but what she actually said was that if having spent 2 weeks in France, by the way, so this conversation is happening in Dover, and she tells me that after 2 weeks in France, that if Jeremy Corbyn gets in, I'll either shoot myself or I'll emigrate. And I'm thinking, you voted for Brexit and you're talking about emigrating. Okay, so I don't know how to square that circle, but I worry that there are people who are just content, as you said, within the Tory party, to just see, you know, because it won't affect them. Like, Rees-Mogg has half his businesses moved to Dublin, for God's sake.
Yeah. I think it's really important, you know, to hammer home that the people who are most keen on no deal are the people who will not be affected. Mm. And the reason why they're so keen for no deal to happen is because they don't have anything at stake. They're incredibly wealthy. They're very healthy. You know, you talked about milk at the border. I think that one of the biggest concerns is, you know, obviously the NHS have been told by the government and by the civil service in London to stockpile, I think, 3 months of every medication that is needed.
Yeah.
And Newsnight had some documents leaked to them in March that said that the NHS were struggling to stockpile insulin and epilepsy medication. And, you know, obviously Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg and lots of hardcore leavers won't be affected by no deal, but there will be milk sitting at borders.
Hmm.
There will be medicine shortages, because there are already medicine shortages, because there is a really, really big problem globally.
Globally, yep.
With medical supplies anyway. And, you know, I think what they haven't factored into the equation is that a lot of people will have their lives directly affected, so there will be problems in supermarkets. But if you have epilepsy or you have diabetes and you can't get your medication and you've previously voted Conservative and you go into a general election, I mean, a lot of people, obviously there will still be some who will vote Tory no matter what, but a lot of people will go into the ballot box and just think, how can I vote for the party that have meant that my wife, my children can't get their insulin, they can't get their epilepsy medication? You know, how can I vote for the party that have made it so that when I go into Tesco, it looks like it's been ransacked?
Yeah.
Because food's not coming through. It will affect a lot of ordinary working people, and that will in turn affect how they vote.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I do think, yeah, without going into the Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. But when the economy is visible on the shop front or on the shelves, as you say, the bare shelves, well, then it's a completely different reality. And the medicine thing is worrying, because there is a global shortage of many medicines now, and we've seen the likes of Bernie Sanders actually speaking about it of late, and how it is it's costing lives. But I suppose, like, best case scenario there from Ireland's point of view was that that it does collapse and there's a general election, because in this island we have our own problems. We have a long list, a litany of problems, from housing to health to education. But we could do without the added burden of, in essentially, the, you know, losing the land bridge, as they call it, and then the difficulties of what will happen on the border. And make no mistake, it will mean that there will have to be a border. You know, it's like, whether it's, they keep saying, is it the UK border in Ireland or the EU's border in Ireland? And that doesn't matter. All this semantics game playing is that they're talking about. It's very worrying. And you see, was it 2 days ago, some Egypt from a wannabe IRA spin-off talking about a return to violence. Yeah, these, I call him an idiot, but people will get hurt, you know. I genuinely don't know if do they care at all.
I don't think they do care, and I think that another problem is that up until, you know, before 2016, a huge number of voters and Conservatives, you know, a huge number of, you know, voters in England, full stop, especially, you know, MPs of the Conservative Party, didn't really know anything about Ireland, and they especially didn't know anything about the North. And I think that, and you know, I think that we've talked a lot about the problems with the border and what will happen in the island. But I think that one thing that the Conservative Party haven't really thought about at all is how kind of people who voted for Brexit will actually react to that. Because, as you said, there is going to have to be a border.
Mm-hmm.
If there isn't a border and it isn't checked, then obviously that works out well for, you know, businessmen and women who are trying to, you know, export and import goods. It works for people who have to cross the border for work and to see their families and things like that. But I think that what they haven't factored in is what hardcore Leave voters, you know, went to the, you know, 2016, they went into the ballot box and they were told repeatedly by Dominic Cummings, the new advisor to Boris Johnson in Number 10, who invented the phrase take back control. And obviously, take back control, the phrase that, you know, span out of all control and really kind of captured the imagination of Leave voters, was all about taking back control of borders. So if best case scenario, you know, the border continues to operate as it does at the moment, and that's still not perfect. There's a lot of racism when it comes to checks on buses, etc. What they haven't thought about is the fact that a lot of English voters who voted for Leave will look at the border and think, hang on, if it's still operating in the same way and there's free movement in Europe, what is stopping somebody coming from France, you know, to Dublin, a refugee, a migrant, and just crossing the border and coming to the UK? And I think a lot of English voters, who voted for Leave, do want to see a hard border. And if there isn't a hard border, then in their mind, that isn't Brexit. And I think the big problem again is that, you know, there are so many problems with UK politics, and obviously the whole fiasco of the last last 2 days is down to the fact that we don't have a written constitution, and the Queen has to rubber stamp everything. But also, like, referenda aren't that common, and unlike in Ireland, when referenda happen, it's often very, very chaotic. So when it came to the Scottish referendum, there was a little bit more thought put into how it would happen. 2016 was, you know, the Brexit referendum was only called because David Cameron, A, thought he could win really easily, so it was nothing but a small vote boost for him. But he only called it because he thought there was a danger that a couple of his MPs would defect to UKIP. And because of that, there was no prep whatsoever. There wasn't a citizens' assembly. There wasn't any proper planning. So when the ballot papers were sent out to all the polling stations, it just said Leave Remain, and nobody said what leaving actually meant. So there are essentially as many ideas of what Brexit is as there are voters. So if we do have any form of Brexit, whether it's a no-deal Brexit, whether it's Theresa May's deal, whether it's some kind of magical new deal Boris Johnson thinks he'll pluck out of nowhere, there will still be a huge number of people for whom whatever that looks like.
It doesn't, yeah. It will never fulfil their expectation of what Brexit was meant to be. You're absolutely right, because, and it goes to the lady I spoke to, and it goes to a few other people who I've spoken to, and they who are of the opposite belief, where, you know, there are, you know, because let's be honest, I'm quite Eurosceptic in my own way. I think there's a democratic deficit, but I do think that, you know, it's also something that can be bettered and reformed and actually brought back to captured by people and more citizen centric, without having to burn down the polarization is not going to fix that. But we don't paint a very bright picture, Dawn. That's my fear. I genuinely do think that the electorate in the UK are being misunderstood. I do think people forget how close Corbyn ran the Conservatives in the last election. And I know we've seen the last 2 years of trying to undermine that, but there is also now some sort of cohesion. But unfortunately, and I mean this as someone who's not an Anglophile, I'm not anti-English either, but I just find it very funny that what this is doing is causing more and more of a fracture amongst that. And no matter what, as you pointed out quite rightly, no matter what the outcome, there are going to be camps that are going to be bitterly disappointed. And, you know, when they don't win, because it's come down to who won. And I think that's what Boris's move is all about, to drive that home. And maybe he's counting on that it'll bring down, and he thinks that his vote plus eating the Brexit Party's vote will get him a majority. I think that's a big risk, but I do think there's an element in his own mind that with that, having assembled that cabinet, I mean, that cabinet was a clear message that it was just, and as you said, Dominic Cummings as the brains behind the operation. There's a very clear message to Europe and to Ireland that, you know, we're intent on going full bore. And unfortunately, I don't think he's going to soften his position.
No, absolutely. And I think that, you know, exactly as you said, the big problem, not the big problem, there are so many big problems. There are no longer any small problems in British politics, it seems.
Yeah.
But, you know, 2016, when the result came out, it essentially kind of opened Pandora's box. There's no way of putting it back in now.
No.
We knew even before the vote that Britain and the UK were very, very divided. But that division was turned fully into a culture war, and mass inequality has been a huge issue in the UK, you know, forever.
Mm.
But since austerity, it became worse, and now everything is focusing on Brexit. Everything is painted as, you know, pure division and extremes, and nobody has any real idea on how to fix this. And the big problem is that because of the way that Boris Johnson is playing this and the way that Conservatives have played it since 2016, everything's about the extremes. When, you know, most people who voted in 2016 are not going to be hardcore leavers who would happily see the economy tank just so long as we leave Europe. And the vast majority of Remain voters are not the kind of people who I see every day now stood outside Parliament wearing EU flags claiming that the European Union is a utopia. Most people who voted Leave or Remain had some good to say about the EU, and, you know, I voted Remain. I do have some issues with the European Union.
Yep.
I think the way they treated Ireland was really awful. I think that, you know, a lot, there are a lot of things that they could do that could make nationalisation of utilities a lot easier. And I think it has been kind of dominated in the last kind of decade or so, as kind of global politics has, by a more right-wing agenda. We're seeing that shifting more to the left. But the vast majority of people aren't hardline Remainers, they're not hardline leavers. And the vast majority of people have been shut out entirely of the whole debate. And what happens after October the 31st? You know, if Brexit does happen, what happens then? What is the agenda? Boris Johnson has to basically give the Queen a piece of paper where she reads out a list of laws that the Conservative Party hope to pass in the next, you know, the next parliamentary like season.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like Netflix, kind of, here's what you missed from... You know,
here's a montage.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody knows what's going to happen because politics has been about nothing but Brexit for years. And there's been, you know, there's a huge crisis in the NHS, in education. There are so many things happening.
I suppose, if I can come in there for a second, I suppose when we first spoke, I spoke to you about your quite brilliant writing around austerity and housing and these things and feminism as well and the feminist movement. But, it's funny because that's all taken a back seat, and now we're still talking about Brexit as opposed to the actual lived experiences of people who are still suffering from, you know, poorer health services, more expensive housing, inadequate housing in most part, and an education system that is failing, and it has been a great distractor in many ways.
Yeah. No, completely. And I remember, you know, I said this to Irish friends repeatedly, that one of the most surprising things to me was the fact that Brexit has in the UK made people think that Leo Varadkar is the smartest, most sensible, most intelligent European leader. And I mean, even yesterday, I remember I was on the BBC with I won't name them, and I was on TV with enough people that nobody will hopefully be able to figure out who it was. But when we were backstage, I mentioned, you know, I said, you know, the Irish Coalition, and he said, what coalition? And I said, you know, like, Leo's in coalition. And even now, these people who are constantly talking about the Irish backstop, talking about Ireland, still don't know anything about Irish politics.
The makeup of our parliament.
Yeah, I had somebody yesterday repeatedly like mispronouncing Sinn Féin to me. While you know, mansplaining Sinn Féin to me. even now, there's still this complete arrogance and this kind of bullish belief that they know best. And that's kind of embedded in a very, very peculiar kind of English nationalist, like we see in the kind of psychodrama in the Conservative Party. So with Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson, their little comrades who went to private school, went to Oxford, moved to London, went into media or politics, and they live in this really tiny bubble. And as we mentioned earlier, they're not going to be affected by Brexit whatsoever, materially, economically. They will, you know, no matter what happens, they'll be able to go on holiday, they'll never run out of food, their family will be fine. And this weird, peculiar little bubble that still don't know very much about politics outside of their immediate experience are basically driving the entire Brexit bus into the channel in between England and France at the moment.
So. Yeah. I think you've put it perfectly, and sadly I don't know if the Lemons are intent on jumping off the cliffs of Dover, can they be stopped? And that would be obviously what has happened in the last 36 hours is that maybe they can't at this stage. So it's, you know, it is down to you actually do need to see people out on the streets. You do need to see protests, because the only way these things will actually get any sort of credence is if there's actually scenes of people looking disaffected as opposed to shrugging their shoulders. But I have to tell you, from this side of the Irish Sea, it's gone well past making me worry. It's gone to the point where I just think we're almost, there's a phrase they use, that the markets price in the loss. I think we're pricing in the loss at this stage. You know, this is what are the costs? How are we going to swallow it? Ireland's looking at loss of 50,000-60,000 jobs in any estimates, and GDP, reduced by 1% or whatever. You know, these things are these mean jobs, and ultimately, if it means jobs, it means well-being, and it means, you know, there's a human cost to all of this. So let's hope that there can be so that the ship can be turned. But it's one big ship that we're trying to turn very quickly now.
I mean, a couple of things. So first of all, you mentioned protests briefly, and I think that yesterday I spoke to CNN. And I've spoken to the CNN journalists quite a lot, and one of them is American, obviously has to come over here quite a lot now to tell Americans about the absolute farce that is going on in London. And, you know, because it is London, there were a huge, huge number of people, very, very short notice, protesting in Parliament. They were very used to protesting at that point. They've done it a huge amount. And, you know, and so the CNN journalist said, there's a lot of people who are doing this very, very clearly. My second point is, I remember, I was thinking about this yesterday, that 2017, I remember waking up and seeing a lot of tweets with a lot of political journalists saying Theresa May's put a podium outside the door in number 10. She's going to announce something, the Conservative Party, and number 10 won't tell us what it is. It could be a general election, could be something else. Sat there watching BBC News, like half the country probably, and she came out, announced a general election, and my phone immediately rang. I answered it, and it was a very panicked-sounding Sky News journalist saying, Dawn, feel free to say no, but I've called a cab, and it's literally driving to your flat right now. I live 10-15 minute drive away from the House of Parliament. Very, very handy for political journalism sometimes. And she said, feel free to say no, but there's a cab coming to your house. I can just cancel it if you want to say no, by all means. And I was like, no problem. I'm I've grabbed my makeup bag.
Yeah.
I do my makeup in the car. So I did my makeup in the cab, got to Parliament. Poor Dan Hodges, kind of right-wing commentator, who I was on with, clearly didn't expect to happen because he was there in an Ed Sheeran t-shirt. at least I had a slightly smarter top on.
Well, we won't talk about Ed. Poor Ed.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, the presenter, Adam Bolton, said to us, said to us both, what do you think is going to happen? And Dan Hodges said what most people thought, which was, you know, so Dan said, this is a genius move from Theresa May. She was really ahead of the polls. It looks really bold and decisive. Theresa May has said, I want a big majority so that I have the power to push through the Brexit that we voted for. And then he turned to me and I said, you know, I know everybody says that she's going to win and Labour will, you know, be booted out. But I think that we need to remember that the British, the public in the UK aren't stupid, and they can clearly look at this. And I said a huge number of people will feel really angry that they're essentially called upon in a really quite cynical and strategic way just to shore up her majority. I said, I think this could really backfire on Theresa May, calling her general election very, very, you know, literally two years after the last one, just to kind of help her job a little bit. I said, I think a lot of the public would be really angry.
They might see it as a stroke, you know?
Yeah, and completely. And I think that, you know, yesterday, I noticed that towards the end of the day, a lot of the kind of tone changed amongst conservative journalists who were coming on TV with me and who were tweeting and writing newspapers. And the conservative journalists instead moved from saying, this is bold, you know, it's a great strategic move, suddenly started saying, this is naturally unusual, we prorogue Parliament all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes, we do, but only for 3 weeks every year for the political party conferences.
Mm.
It is actually unprecedented to do it for 5 weeks, and it is very obvious that Boris Johnson is doing it for his own means, that he is using the very peculiar British democratic tools to try and help him. And again, I think, you know, the British public will look at this and see how outrageous it is. I mean, there was some polling done almost instantly about what people in the UK think about what Boris Johnson did, and it's incredibly negative. The Conservative Party are genuinely quite worried about how badly this is playing for them. They thought that this would be seen as very bold and very dangerous, and it was a way of telling Remainers to get back in the box. And over and over again, like, you know, I'm sure that you've heard this as well, every single time any concern is brought up about Brexit, Leavers try and shut it down instantly by saying, just project fear.
Project fear.
Over and over again. And, you know, it may have worked at the beginning, but now when insulin shortages and the prospect of a hard border
the pound tanking and one of the lowest performing economies in the EU for the last couple of years. Like, I mean, these are realities already, you know?
You can't carry on saying this is project fear.
Mm.
I mean, I genuinely don't think that, like, the pound collapsing is something that somebody has made up. It's not project fear. It's an actual fact. It has happened. It has happened because of Brexit. It's, you know, you can't keep saying project fear forever. And especially if we do go into a no deal Brexit, when these realities do bite home and are actually there, you can't keep saying project fear. They have to come up with another way of explaining why this is worth it why it wasn't planned for, why people should have to put up with this, and also what happens next. At no point have any of the Conservatives come out and said, you know, what will happen to the UK after we leave Brexit. It's all been about how we leave.
Mm.
And obviously, you know, over and over again, every time I speak to people about what about a possible border poll, about what a United Ireland might look like. A lot of thought has been put into that. A lot of thought has been put into all the different possibilities that would come from a border poll. None of that has happened with Brexit. So it's all focused on how you get to the point where we leave the European Union, and no thought has been put into what happens afterwards. So if you're supposedly then free of the European Union, like, what are you going to do that the EU was previously stopping you from doing? What will a new UK look like outside of Europe? And there's nothing about that. What happens after that? And it feels like we're completely divided. Obviously, it's been framed as a culture war between Leavers and Remainers. The vast majority of the public don't see themselves primarily as defined by their position on Europe. Yeah. But more than that, it's shown that the union is at stake. There's huge disquiet amongst the entire country. Obviously, there's a lot of problems in like Northern Ireland and Wales and Scotland and England. There's a lot of slippage between all four parts of the union and what their future is, how they're treated by Westminster, how they're treated by the government. But also, even within those regions, there are huge regional inequalities, there are huge political differences, as we all know, between every region. And, you know, everything is so precarious at the moment. Anything could happen. Nobody knows what will happen. And no real thought is being put into what will happen afterwards.
I think on that pessimistic note, I think we will leave it there, Dawn. I would love to be ringing you back and just talking about the fact of, you know, let's talk about the issues that are facing the individuals on the ground, the housing shortage, the crisis in education, and, you know, a decent working living wage versus a minimum wage, and these kind of things, and maybe we will get back there, and let's be hopeful that maybe we will avert, and this big the Titanic will dodge the iceberg, and let's hope that is possible. But Dawn Foster, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
And it was a delight as ever to come on. Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, folks. If you could do us a favour, head over onto patreon.com/tortoiseshack. These podcasts, while they are great to do and really rewarding, they are not viable and they need support. That's the price of a cup of coffee really helps us out. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.